This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, November 13th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton. We'll speak with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette and Jessica Hill from the Cape Cod Times. We'll check in with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror and Casey Myers from the Provincetown Independent. We'll hear from Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times, Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, and we'll hear from CAI's Mike Dean at the State House. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Governor Baker has been urging schools to get students back into the classroom, and the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education issued new guidance last Friday saying that only the highest risk communities should use a hybrid school model. CAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us with this story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Jeanette, the department said fully remote education should be used only as a last resort. That could be a big change for some schools. What's the local reaction been?
Right. Well, I asked that question of Vera Harik, who's the deputy director of the Barnstable County Department of Human Services. And she says the administration is following science on this issue, which is laudable and appreciated here, she says. So that was kind of an issue for our times, right? The idea of like following science. But she says it appears that state officials in both education and public health are looking at that emerging research that suggests students do better academically when they go to school in person. They can also possibly do better psychologically, she said. But how that will trickle down to local school districts is really unclear. Harik says the districts have local control over those decisions. As far as we know, that hasn't changed. So whether they want to alter their plans mid-year will likely be a decision made locally. And no doubt those districts will be considering how parents and families might feel about that. Some may really be looking forward to their kids going back. Others might prefer to kind of continue for now on the road of their own.
Now, Governor Baker said this week the state is readying field hospitals in case they need to reopen this winter to accept an overflow of COVID-19 patients from hospitals. In the spring, a field hospital was set up at Joint Base Cape Cod. Is that one included in the governor's readiness plan?
Senator Sears says that Joint Base Cape Cod could reopen fairly easily as a field hospital because it was closed in such a way that it could be prepared to reopen on shorter notice. But unless we see significantly more COVID-19 cases than we had in the spring, it's not really likely to open anytime soon. At the time in the spring, the field hospital was only open for a few weeks and then it closed without ever seeing any patients, which is good news, right? So because Cape Cod Healthcare had set up a COVID-19 step-down units at two vacant nursing homes on the Cape. And even those were more than enough to fill the need at the time. So they were never really utilized to capacity either. So whether or not we really would have to open the field hospital, it's unknown. It would take a very serious spike in cases for that.
And the Cape Cod Reopening Task Force is urging people to keep taking all the usual precautions for COVID-19 as we move indoors. And that means wearing masks, keeping a proper distance, washing hands. Last week, Senator Sears cited a lack of easily available testing across the Cape. Has there been any expansion of testing locally?
Well, the county is still waiting for state money approved by the legislature to open its own testing program. And Sear maintains that the Cape is a testing desert, especially when you look at it relative to the number of cases here. He showed reporters a map of the state. And in the Berkshires, where, of course, it's rural, they also have low testing rates, but they have many towns with no COVID-19 cases at all. The Cape has apparently more cases relative to the testing availability here. So that characterization of a desert, I guess, kind of holds true. Last week, the Community Health Center of Cape Cod, though, announced it was offering asymptomatic testing in Falmouth and in Mashpee.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes joining us. Thank you, Jeanette.
Thanks, Steve.
If you were sleeping in on Sunday morning, you might likely have been awakened by an unexpected jolt, a prolonged shaking. Yes, we experienced an earthquake. CAI Sam Houghton joins us with this and other news. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Sam, tell me, what was your first reaction to the quake?
Yes, I was not sleeping in, but oddly, I as a morning edition producer, I wake up at 4, but oddly, you know, I thought my hot water heater was about to blow up, but it's funny because I think a lot of other people we heard from had the same reaction, but really, it was the noise that got it. It sounded like a big truck was kind of driving towards the house, and it kept kind of getting louder and louder for just for like a few seconds. But it definitely felt it too. You know, I've never really felt anything like it. Pretty strange feeling. You don't think about earthquakes. Yeah, I mean, you know, you don't think about earthquakes much here, but it turns out we do have them. You know, maybe not very frequently, but this one was one of the larger earthquakes we've ever had. It's the largest in almost 30 years, I guess, but we had a 3.7 magnitude earthquake. This was 3.6. Originally, it was reported as a 4.2 and then down to 4.0 before, I guess, resting on 3.6. But yeah, my first reaction, you know, when I knew it was an earthquake was to check for a tsunami warning, you know, being on the coast. But it turns out that tsunamis are really only a danger after big earthquakes.
What do we know about where it was located and how far it was felt?
Yeah, so this was apparently felt as far as Long Island, which is pretty amazing. USGS says the epicenter of the earthquake was in Buzzards Bay, in the actual water about a mile off Mecham Point. That's in Dartmouth. So the New Bedford kind of south coast area probably felt it the most. There was minimal damage reported, but no major damage that we know of. No one was injured either. The mayor in New Bedford warned people to check their chimneys, especially if they're connected to boilers or hot water heaters. I think you'll hear more about that later in the show. But yeah, you know, certainly a scary moment, kind of neat in a way. But I guess, you know, in 2020, we should no longer be surprised by anything.
We heard from a lot of people saying they thought maybe something happened in the basement, the furnace, something happened with the furnace, or there was a traffic accident. I think people aren't. Obviously, we're not programmed to think earthquake on Cape Cod. So,
yeah, no, totally.
A couple of years ago, it was a tornado. Now we got an earthquake. Sam, I just want to say a little later in the program, we are going to hear from Jack Spillane from the Standard Times about damage that forced some people from their homes in New Bedford. So we'll be carrying this story forward. Sam, looking at another story you reported this week, Sue Moran is heading back to the State House, this time to serve a full term as the senator representing the Plymouth and Barnstable District. Turns out she's part of a historic class of legislators. What's this about?
Yeah, so women will make up about a third of legislature this term, 62 women, a dozen in the Senate, 50 in the House. That's five more than the previous record. So the most women ever to serve in the state legislature. Just a little history here. The first woman elected to the Massachusetts House was in 1923. They were Representative Sylvia Donaldson of Brockton, Susan Fitzgerald of Jamaica Plain. I don't know if people know those names. But since then, 213 women have served in the state legislature. But you know, that's compared to the 20,000 men who have served. Mm. Still, this latest round, is, you know, joining the House and Senate, including Sue Moran, it's a neat milestone.
That is CAI Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
Martha's Vineyard is seeing new highs for COVID-19 cases this week. Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette is here to talk about it. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, give us an overview of the numbers so people know what's going on here, and then maybe we can talk a little about the response.
Yeah, so over the past week, the island has reported, I believe it's at this point, 54 cases since Monday. started with 20 cases that were reported over the weekend. And the way cases here are reported is that they're generally reported by both the hospital and our other testing site. And so there's some overlap, and it sometimes can be difficult to parse out how many cases there actually are. But there was about 20 cases reported on Monday, and then there were similar numbers reported each day throughout the week on Wednesday and Thursday. And just to give a little bit of comparison, those might not seem like huge numbers for people who are on the Cape or mainland, but we haven't had anything close to that since the pandemic began. 20 is more cases than we were having in entire months earlier in the year.
So what is some of the response that we're seeing? There were cases in the schools, also cases linked to a Kronig supermarket, and then just scattered cases in the community because there's the belief now that community transmission is there. Yeah.
Right. So public health officials are saying that community spread is happening, which is something they haven't said since the pandemic started. And it really has touched, you know, just this wide variety of different aspects of the public and, you know, basically public life. We've had two town meetings that have been canceled, Oakbus and Aquinnah. We've had schools. So there's been cases in the schools. Now, the school superintendent is adamant that the cases were not transmitted within the school buildings, and that all of the people who have tested positive who are connected to the schools tested positive outside, or, you know, the way transmission happened was outside the school buildings. But Edgartown School did decide to postpone their expanded in-person learning. There's been on a sort of civic level, a lot of sort of pressure to further enforce public health guidelines. I think public health officials have said that COVID fatigue is definitely setting in. I'm sure that's something that people are noticing elsewhere as well.
When you say COVID fatigue, you mean people are kind of relaxing their adherence to the rules and no longer doing all the things they should do.
Right. We've been doing this for so many months now. And at least on the island, there had never been a large case spike. And especially at the beginning of the pandemic, when everyone was getting first into that initial lockdown, that didn't happen here in the same way that it happened elsewhere. And so I think no one here had ever seen it. And beyond all of that, there also was a case cluster that occurred at Kronig's Market, which is one of the biggest and most prominent grocery stores on the island. And that forced the grocery store to be closed from last Friday to this Thursday, which it has reopened, but there's been 14 cases among employees and then another 4 among their families. So that accounts for a good chunk of the cases, but not all of them.
Is there a feeling that the island is moving to address all of this, that there's a will on the island to up the game here?
Yes. That's sort of what I think everyone's getting at, but it's difficult to know exactly because not all the contact tracing's been done. So public health officials aren't sure exactly where all the cases are coming from and how they were transmitted. And so they don't know exactly what to address and needs to be, you know, beefed up. But I think they have been saying from sort of anecdotal experience that mask wearing needs to be stronger. Social distancing guidelines and gathering rules need to be adhered to completely. Travel rules need to be adhered to. And I think back when there wasn't a case spike happening, they felt they could play more of an educational role on the island. And I think now they feel like they might have to play more of an enforcement role, which is within their purview. By state rules.
That is Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette joining us. Noah, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. A Mashpee teen has been missing since the third week of October. Jessica Hill has been following the story for the Cape Cod Times, and she joins us now. Hi, Jessica.
Hey, Steve.
Jessica, for anyone who hasn't been following this case, tell us what we know about the circumstances of the disappearance of Jalaja Finkley.
So Jalaja Finkley was last seen October 20th around 4:50 p.m. by her mother in New Bedford. A police report actually found that she is 5 months pregnant, and earlier the day that she disappeared, she underwent the first part of a two-part medical procedure in Boston. And Finkley's mother left home to pick up a prescription for her. around 4:50, and then when she came back around 5:30 p.m., Finkley was gone. Costa called the New Bedford Police Department when she received a call the next day from a clinic informing her that Finkley never showed up for her follow-up appointment. And the suspect in her disappearance, his name's Louis Zaragoza. He's 37, and he also goes by the name Louis Barboza. He was shot and killed last Thursday in Florida as U.S. Marshals tried to take him into custody. He had been charged with kidnapping and larceny of a motor vehicle. So, he previously dated Finkley's aunt, so that's kind of how they knew each other.
It's a little bit complicated to lay out here, but I just want to walk through it a little bit for people who haven't been following. So Finkley was seen getting into the car of Barboza, is that right? And that's how they kind of connected these Zaragoza. So this is how they connected them together. She disappeared. And since then, police have been tracking Zaragoza, who's also known as Barboza, across the country or down the East Coast.
Definitely, yeah. So they, all of her family knew that it was him from the beginning. She had last texted a friend saying that she was about to meet with him. And then they also used a lot of surveillance footage, and they found that Finkley was last seen getting into his car. It was a rental from Logan International Airport, and she was also wearing like slippers, and she wasn't carrying any bags. So there was no evidence that she planned to leave home. And they tracked him with cell phone records to New Jersey, and then down to West Virginia, and then down to Texas. He first went to Florida, and then to Texas, and then back to Florida again, which is where the U.S. Marshals tried to apprehend him.
And some of they found surveillance footage of him in his car in some of these locations, but he's always been alone, it appears. Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct. Yep.
And then tell us a little bit around what we know about the circumstances of how the police were trying to apprehend him in Florida and ended up being killed by police.
Right. So he was in a Crestview McDonald's parking lot, and that's when they tried to approach. They knew that he had a handgun on him, and he shot out of the car, and then that's when an officer shot him back. And that is under investigation by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. And Finkley is still missing. Anyone with any information about the case is asked to call the New Bedford Police Department at 508-991-6360. She could be, you know, in South Carolina, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Texas, or Florida.
And as you said, she's believed to be 5 months pregnant. We also got some information from the mother of Zaragoza, Louis Zaragoza, who was killed, saying that he was dealing with mental health issues through this time.
Yes, his mother told police that he has been suffering from depression and wasn't receiving any treatment for it. He also has a history of suicidal ideation, and he had tried to commit suicide in the past. Mm. She also said that he has the mental capacity of a teenager, too.
It is a troubling story. We're thinking of the family members here and hoping for a safe return for Jalaysia Finkley. Jessica Hill from the Cape Cod Times, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Have a good one.
The island of Nantucket was shaken, quite literally, by an explosion yesterday that destroyed a home. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror is on the line now. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, what do we know about this explosion? What might have caused it, and was anyone in the house when it happened?
A couple of things. There was someone in the house at the time of the explosion, which occurred at just about exactly noon yesterday in a home on Woodbury Lane, which is just outside downtown Nantucket, a very sort of densely populated residential street of mostly seasonal residents. There was one person inside. He was transported by ambulance to Nantucket Cottage Hospital with potentially serious injuries, Fire Chief Steve Murphy said yesterday. A second person in a neighboring home also took themselves to the hospital with unknown injuries that are not believed to be serious, Murphy said. It's not immediately known what caused the explosion, although fire investigators are looking at a potential for propane as the potential cause of that, but they have released no information about that yet. Two houses on either side of the property sustained major damage. The property itself was completely leveled. The second floor dormers from the home were in the or on the ground. There was furniture and other debris strewn all the way across the street. Windows were knocked out in a number of houses up and down the street. The neighborhood was evacuated. You could see a plume of smoke more than a mile away. And the explosion itself was felt and heard from one end of the island to the other, literally maybe 10 miles away. And this is the
last
second explosion.
Week, yeah, I was going to say, last week we talked about a fire that seemed to have an explosion linked to it. Is there any idea of connection here or not?
The fire department, Fire Chief Murphy, is saying absolutely no connection between the two other than a potential cause, and they haven't listed a cause of the initial explosion last Wednesday either. At this point, they are also looking into the possibility of some type of gas explosion. Nantucket does not have municipal gas. There are no gas lines running through neighborhoods. All gas that is used for heating and cooking purposes on the island, it comes in propane tanks, usually obviously outside of homes. But again, these are still under investigation. The State Fire Marshal's Office, investigators from the State Fire Marshal's Office are expected to be on the island today to investigate this latest Woodbury Lane explosion.
Also this week, Josh, the recent spike in COVID cases on the island has the Nantucket Board of Health taking action. What's the latest here?
The latest is that the Board of Health met yesterday. They did not, as they were contemplating, limit the number of workers that are allowed on job sites down to six. They decided against that. They implemented a few more stringent COVID precaution protocols, including mandating a COVID compliance officer be on all job sites, who will be charged with recording any symptoms and the names and of all the workers on the job sites, any kind of log about workers sent home. But the Board of Health decided not to limit the number of workers on the island. The latest couple of spikes have been attributed to workers in the trades who our health director, Roberto Santamaria, said are contracting the virus on the job and then bringing it home and infecting members of their households and other potential close acquaintances. An island-wide mask order and a limit on gatherings, both indoors and outside, has to 10, has been in place on Nantucket since October 6th. There are no additional restrictions being contemplated by the Health Board at this time. Nantucket now has 254 confirmed coronavirus cases since the beginning of the pandemic, including 38 in the last week, 11 on Saturday, 12 on Monday, and 7 were reported on Wednesday.
And, Josh, finally, the Select Board is grappling with another issue, dangerous dogs, and just how island dogs are managed overall. Tell us about this.
Sure. This particular instance stems from a fine that the Select Board levied against a woman who is now living off-island after one of her dogs was off its leash and attacked another dog last month. This is a dog that the Select Board had declared a nuisance dog last year after it attacked and killed a number of chickens and ducks and some other animals. But deeper into the discussion really is what the town should do about nuisance and problem dogs. The town does have a leash law, but the police chief himself says it's probably the most unenforced and unabided by bylaws that the town has. The Select Board has discussed the matter a little bit. They're considering any number of options, looking at stepping up enforcement, increasing fines. Nantucket has traditionally been known as a very dog-friendly place, and that has translated sometimes into dogs being off leashes on beaches, on conservation properties, and town officials are saying that really shouldn't be the case, especially during the busier times of the year when other people and other dogs are around, dog owners really need to leash their dogs. Some of the things being considered are potentials for dog-free and dog-specific beaches, dog-free and dog-specific parks to provide some separation, perhaps, so that dogs could potentially be off-leash in certain places at certain times of the year. But nothing has been set in stone yet. Nothing has been formalized, and this is a discussion that's going to probably keep going on for some months.
It's Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks.
Thank you.
An Eastham museum has rediscovered some Native American artifacts, which have become part of a new display. Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent has the story for us and joins us. Hi, Casey.
Hello, how are you?
Casey, this is the 1869 Schoolhouse Museum. Tell us how they came to realize they had artifacts in their possession and what they're about.
Okay, well, the volunteers of the Schoolhouse Museum in Eastham were looking at ways to represent the indigenous story in the display for the 400th anniversary of the landing of the Mayflower. And of course, we on Cape Cod know the Mayflower first landed in Provincetown, not Plymouth. So they were trying to create an indigenous display, and they were talking to the Cape Cod National Seashore historian about another big find that was also in Eastham in 1990, the Carnes archaeological site at Coast Guard Beach, which unearthed remains of Native American life from the early woodland period to the middle woodland period, an estimated 2100 to 1100 years ago. And that's a time period for which there was very little known. So anyway, they were talking about the Carnes material, and the volunteers realized that they had similar artifacts stored in their own museums in boxes that were tucked away under the eaves of the former schoolhouse. So they got a $1,000 grant from the Daughters of the American Revolution and hired Dan Zotto, an archaeologist. He reviewed the 533 pieces in the museum collection and found something very exciting, that part of this collection had 48 artifacts recovered by a man named Henry Guild, who on his property, who lived at Salt Pond Creek. And Zotto said those 48 pieces provide evidence of Native American life dating back 3,500 years ago at that Salt Pond Creek area. Yeah. And so because those particular pieces could be traced to an actual location, they have provenance, and the Mass Historical Commission ended up registering a new archaeological site in Eastham near Salt Pond Creek because of this.
When you see the pictures of these, I just want to describe a little bit for people what we're looking at. You see the pictures, they're like arrowheads or points for other kind of tools. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Yeah. Which you know, I feel like people often come across on their properties, and you know, it's not unheard of to find these materials, but Eastham seems to have a real treasure trove of artifacts from the Native American life. It's not the first or the second time I've heard about Eastham having new discoveries. I think when they were working on the library, they put a trailer at the town hall so that people could use a temporary library site, and there was another find during that construction. Anyway,
tell us what they're going to do with these artifacts here. Yes, go ahead.
Sure. So some of the artifacts, a different set from the 48 pieces from the Henry Guild property, they seem to come from the digging up of a burial site, a Native American burial site in the 1930s. Because those pieces are culturally sensitive, they will never be displayed, and all the items will eventually be returned to the Wampanoag tribe in Mashpee. In the meantime, the museum's closed, but the archaeologist Dan Zotto's video presentation is available on the website, easthamhistoricalsociety.org/past-present.
Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent with the story there, and a fun one. Thanks, Casey.
Well, you had to get away from the pandemic sometimes, right?
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
A Pocasset woman got a shock this week. She received a bill for a coronavirus test on her son, who had died 15 years ago. Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times has this story, and she joins us. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning.
Cindy, this is an attention-getting headline, and rightfully so. What is going on here?
Well, Karen Eldridge of Pocasset said that she went out to her mailbox on Monday and she found a bill from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. It was addressed to her son, Dana Wicklin, who died. He died at age 34 in 2005. Now, he'd had surgery at Beth Israel Deaconess. He died following the surgery. He had a congenital heart condition since he was a baby, since he was born, and that was his latest surgery. And so she thought, well, maybe it's an old bill, and she opened it up, though, and found out it was for a rapid COVID test that was taken on October 21st, and he was billed the full amount, $120.
So her son had been dead since 2005, and here she is receiving a bill for a rapid COVID test.
Well, she went on Facebook, and that's where, you know, and just saying, you know, she was she was upset. Obviously, this is her son. This is a bill to him. And obviously, he didn't take the test. And it just brings up memories and it just brings up feelings. And she went on Facebook. And that's where, you know, we got wind of it, that this had happened to her, and talked to her. And she said she just wants answers about what happened. And she wasn't real thrilled with her conversation with billing at Beth Israel. She said that she talked to a woman in the billing department who was very nice and apologized. And then when she talked to a supervisor, that he actually just was sort of abrupt with her, or at least not contrite, and said, well, maybe, you know, someone else has the same name and the same birth date, which she finds very unlikely, because Dana Wicklund is not, you know, as she pointed out, that's not the same as John Smith. So she doesn't know what happened yet. And she was concerned, you know, if there was something bigger going on. She just wanted some answers. And I did speak to someone who works for the Boston VA to explain the test. First of all, there's two types of rapid tests that you can get, an antigen test or the polymerase chain reaction molecular test, which is kind of considered the gold standard. That's, you know, that's what's considered an absolutely confirmed test. And both, and in either case, they're on-site tests. You would be there to get the test. And depending on the type of test, you could get the results from 5 minutes to several hours. So, the scientist who works for the VA also said that there's a whole billing procedure that they have, and this is different from Beth Israel, because Beth Israel won't talk to me about their billing procedure. But he said, you know, the person's the first initial of their last name is entered into the computer data entry along with the last four digits of their social security number. Sometimes different, you know, several names will pop up, and then they have to go through and make sure that they have the right patient. He said at the VA, in the case of the VA, if the patient has died, then they will get a notification, the patient has died, do you wish to proceed? And sometimes they do wish to proceed because they just took the test just before the patient's death, and they want to know the results of that test. And he also said that, you know, there is hundreds and thousands of these tests being performed. So there is a potential there for clerical error, that, you know, someone typed in the wrong number and typed in some digits or something and someone popped up. I don't know, you know, what the notification system is at Beth Israel, because as I mentioned, they didn't speak to me about that. But there are hundreds and thousands of these tests that are going on right now every day, yes. Every day at some of the bigger hospitals.
And obviously she's not going to pay this bill.
She's not going to pay the bill, but she would like answers. And I think she'll be getting in touch with their patient relations people who take more time. And I did speak to someone at Beth Israel, their media relations, who said that when there's a billing error, they will do a full investigation. So hopefully she'll have some answers as to how this happened. And these tests are very in demand. People want these tests. They're used for travel, if you're going to travel. I mean, a ton of people would be getting them now before Thanksgiving. They're used for to go back to work. Some people need to have these tests to go back to work. There's a lot of these tests are highly in demand, but obviously her son did not have this test.
Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker, broadcasting from my home office. We'll have more in a moment. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. Sunday morning's earthquake displaced some people on the South Coast from their homes. Jack Spillane from the Standard Times in New Bedford has this story. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Steve.
Jack, tell us about these families that found themselves forced out of their homes because of the earthquake.
Well, you know, New Bedford has a very old housing stock. Many tenements, triple-deckers, two-family homes that are quite old and not in the best of repair sometimes. And the earthquake, of course, was just several miles off of nearby Dartmouth in Buzzards Bay. And so although it was felt everywhere, it was felt really strongly in greater New Bedford. So people, after the earthquake, I know it shook my house pretty badly. I almost immediately knew what it must be. Went down to the basements to check out their chimneys. And we had four or five homes in the south end of New Bedford on Crapo Street, Nelson Street, that area, where the chimneys crumbled. Well, of course, a crumbling chimney, particularly if it's home to gas lines and other things, is an immediate danger. So the Red Cross came in, and about 20 people in all were evacuated, put up by the Red Cross. the fire chief had everyone in the city, particularly the southern part of the city, checking their chimneys and foundations for damage. Could have been a lot worse, but unnerving.
Unnerving, and you point out that it's not something that's just immediately remedied. These folks are going to be dealing with this for a little while, and their lives are disrupted.
Yes, there's no insurance covering earthquakes in New England now. So you're really going to have to absorb that cost. People talked about not being able to take showers or cook. I think in several of the homes, they wouldn't even let them back in until it's repaired. But it was a lot of upheaval for people and quite nerve-wracking. Did you feel it strongly down the Cape?
So I live in Woods Hole, and actually we're not that far, across Buzzards Bay. It was located in the water, Buzzards Bay, as they say. So yes, I felt it very strongly Sunday morning, and knew right away almost what it was, and was amazed that it had happened. Yes, but yeah, no damage reported on this end. Yeah.
Yeah. So the fire chief advised people how to look for signs of crumbling in their chimneys. I think probably the best thing is to get a professional in. But all in all, it was a small number of people. But even so, 4 or 5 homes, 20 people, was distressing.
Yes, distressing, and not something that we expect to have happen here. People being displaced by earthquake damage in our region. Jack Spillane from the Standard Times in New Bedford. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
A Martha's Vineyard artist has been focusing her efforts on the Black Lives Matter movement. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times has this story and joins us now. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, this story is really a bit of a journey. Tell us about Elisa Cohen and her path into these efforts to raise awareness on the island.
Yeah, like a lot of people, Elisa and her husband decided to spend more time on the island this year, coming from New York City. And they noticed a gathering every morning at Beetlebum Corner for Black Lives Matter. And one morning she just decided to stop by. She was out running errands, and she wanted to see what it was all about. And this had been organized by a woman named Dana Nunes. Pretty early on, Amy Schumer, who a lot of people know as an actor and comedian, joined in, and they kneel every day for a different person who has been affected, in some cases killed by the police. And so this particular woman, Elisa Cohen, she said, she wanted to know more about these people. And so she went home and did some research, and she started to draw them because she wanted to be able to put a face with the names of the people that they were talking about at each of these rallies. And these have become a daily rally, by the way. And so she started creating this art and bringing it with her, and people started holding them at the Beetlebum Corner demonstration. So it's pretty powerful. I mean, people would have to click into the story and take a look at some of the artwork, but she does a really good job of depicting some of the people who, George Floyd and Tamir Rice and DJ Henry and some of the other people who have been killed at the hands of police.
And it's really a visual to bring to life, as you say, the stories behind this movement here, which is still an active, pressing issue for our communities. Let me ask you about a different story you covered. We have a little bit of a delay on the line, I can tell. Sometimes Martha's Vineyard seems even farther from the mainland than it really is. I can look across the water and see it. But speaking to you, there's this strange delay on the line sometimes. Let me ask you, George, some That's islanders, right. happy about the results in last week's election, celebrated in an unusually bracing manner. Tell us about this story.
Yeah, so as you know, there were people honking horns places. There were people getting out in the streets. On Martha's Vineyard, a group of people decided that it would be a good idea to take a plunge into the water. There is a group on the island. They're known as the Polar Bears, and it's a group that has gathered for 75 years. This wasn't an official polar bear plunge, but they gathered nonetheless to celebrate the victory of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. They felt that like they wanted to do something. And so as some of them said, this was a bit of a cleansing as well of Donald Trump and the 4 years that they've gone through with that administration. It was a very happy celebration. You know, people took their plunge, dried off afterwards, and shared a little bit of a beverage afterwards to toast Joe Biden's victory. So it was not something that I would do. But how about you, Steve?
Not something I would do, but I will say they had a beautiful day for it that Saturday. The sunshine but still too cool for me. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Take care.
State lawmakers are sifting through some 800 amendments as they rush to get a budget for the fiscal year onto Governor Baker's desk by Thanksgiving, which is just under 2 weeks away. Meanwhile, state officials are starting to develop a picture of what a new presidential administration might mean for Massachusetts when Joe Biden takes office in January. CAI's Catherine Iden spoke about these stories and more with our State House reporter Mike Dean. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
Well, we're finally in a much-delayed budget season on Beacon Hill, and lawmakers are sifting through just under 800 amendments. That seems like a lot of extra work on a budget that in reality should have been finalized last summer.
Yeah, it's actually significantly fewer amendments than members usually file onto the annual budget plan. So they are taking heed to some of the instructions from the Speaker and the Senate President, as well as the Governor, to get this budget done pronto. That's kind of been the mantra here. I know they've waited for so long, but essentially they were waiting to see what the state's finances were going to look like, tax revenues, how they would be affected by the pandemic shutdowns, and what's happening to the state taxes. So in order to balance this budget, they're using over one-third of the state's rainy day savings to keep up that amount of spending. So there's going to be, you know, a $45 billion budget passed, and each member wants their piece of the pie, and that's what these amendments are. So whenever, you know, your state rep brings you to the, you know, the senior center's new wing or the new fire engine in town, that's usually because of budget amendments like this. They're getting through that process. They will have passed the final budget on to the Senate. We're going to take up the similar process next week. The biggest factor when they finally pulled the trigger to get it done is because they finally realized there wasn't going to be any kind of bailout coming from the federal government.
This doesn't seem related, but in fact it is, and that is abortion access. The debate on whether to expand access has been going on for some time, but now it's back in the news, and that's because it is tied to the budget, right?
Yeah, so after telling us that the House budget plan wasn't going to have any policy elements to it, because, you know, the budget is so big, you can kind of shove whatever new laws you want into the document. DeLeo said there wasn't going to be any policy, and then turned around and said, except for this majorly controversial abortion bill that, you know, known as the Roe Act, that's been floating around for some time. Both DeLeo and the Senate President Karen Spilka vowed to bring it to a vote this session around the time of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing and Amy Coney Barrett's appointment to the Supreme Court. This bill would essentially lock in a lot of the abortion rights that already exist in mass law, and it would essentially do away with parental consent for women over 16 years old when they seek an abortion. And that's the compromise from the original Roe Act before. It didn't have that 16-year-old minimum. That now is put in place as something of a compromise for more moderate Democrats who might have been squishy about voting for an abortion bill. The other major thing this does is it would, for the first time, allow abortion after 24 weeks in cases of fatal fetal anomalies when a pregnancy wouldn't be viable. But now with that change and the fact that it is after the election and well before the next election, members are going to take it up as part of the budget, get it done quickly. That's kind of the way that these social issues get passed on Beacon Hill.
I want to turn now to how things might look in Massachusetts in January, and that's when Joe Biden, president-elect, will take office. What are Massachusetts leaders, especially Governor Charlie Baker, looking for from Biden once he takes over the White House?
It's pretty ideal for Baker when you look at it in a certain way. You know, he's a fairly moderate Republican in Massachusetts. He wants a functional federal government to help out the state. And he won't have to, you know, bite his tongue any time the President Trump comes up anymore because he'll be out of office. I think Baker's been walking a tightrope for 4 years now, criticizing Trump when he does extreme things and kind of putting things off and not getting into the national fray at other times. So a Biden administration would be pretty perfect for somebody like Baker if you think not only do you want the steady governing from the White House that you didn't get under Trump, but also he has that Republican Senate that's going to be a check on any of the more radical proposals Democrats might try to pursue through a Biden agenda. So for the center, for Charlie Baker, that kind of middle ground is going to be pretty good for him. If history is any guide, voters will at least be a little bit lukewarm to Biden's first 2 years. So if the 2022 election is a more conservative element in the air, Baker could do well at re-election if he wants to run for a third term. When it comes to higher office for Baker, you know, there's very little to indicate that he would either join the Biden administration or try to become a new type of Republican to challenge the Democratic president at that level. So I think, you know, look more towards that third term than anything else.
Would there be any funding in store for Massachusetts under a new Biden presidency?
Yeah, it's important to remember that, you know, Congress has been waiting for this, you know, bailout stimulus bill for an awfully long time to put this together. Negotiations between the House and White House kept failing over and over again. But Massachusetts has a number of senior people in the House leadership, people, you know, like Representatives McGovern, Neal, Catherine Clark, very close to Speaker Nancy Pelosi. That could prove very beneficial for what an eventual state and local government bailout bill, you know, part of a stimulus could look like.
And finally, before I let you go, Mike, I want to make note of history. The state legislature will have the most women ever in the House and Senate.
Yeah, it's right. There's 62 women. So it's going to be a dozen women in the Senate and 50 in the House now. That includes State Senator Sue Moran, who got reelected to her first full term from the Cape and Plymouth district that Vinnie DiMaceto vacated when he left. So she's sticking around in the Senate. There are a number of women who are replacing men in the House in different seats, and it is a record.
And that is State House reporter Mike Dean talking with us from Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
That is CAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean from the State House there. We have a little bit of breaking news for you. We'll be following throughout the day. The FBI announcing it has arrested Cedric Cromwell, chairman of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, for allegedly using his position to enrich himself by extorting tens of thousands of dollars in bribes and engaging in a conspiracy with David DeQuatro of Warwick, Rhode Island, to commit bribery. That's a statement from the FBI. We'll be following that throughout the day. That is our show for today. I want to thank my guests, CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton. We spoke with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, Jessica Hill from the Cape Cod Times, heard from Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent. We spoke with Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times, Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, and of course, Mike Dean there up at the State House. Big thanks to Dan Tridle back at the studio. When the cord pulls out of my home broadcasting unit, he's the cool voice that steps in and keeps everything running smoothly. I'm Steve Junker from my home in Woods Hole. Thank you for listening.